New Year's greetings and Rama Krisma Hanukkah Tide celebrations, my delectably moribund listeners, and welcome to this December 2014 Science News Update. I'm your host for this demonstrably gradacious science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. We are not snowed in quite yet, but we are certainly headed in that direction. I wish you all the innate blessings of this wonderfully benighted Yuletide season. I have some awesome presents for you since the 12 days of Christmas are still not up, so let's just get started. First, a big exoplanet update and a new record. I have to admit I was a bit surprised at this one because I had thought we'd already passed this mark a long time ago. But apparently, up to the last couple of months or so, no astronomer had yet found a small exoplanet with water. And technically, they still have not. After a year and a half on the Hubble, Spitzer, and Kepler space telescopes, Dr. Jonathan Frain, an astronomer at the University of Maryland, discovered the smallest, coolest exoplanet known to host water is roughly the size of Neptune. The work was published in the journal Nature at the end of September. Previously, researchers had found water only on exoplanets that are about the size of Jupiter or so. And frankly, that surprised me. I swear I read about smaller water worlds. At any rate, the planet, HAT P11b, is just over four times as wide as Earth. Gases like water vapor in a planet's upper atmosphere leave their mark by absorbing specific frequencies of light. And when HAT P11b comes between Earth and its star, the planet's atmosphere filters out some of the starlight. The astronomers detected water by observing infrared light that disappeared each time the planet passed between Earth and its host, which is an orange dwarf star about 122 light years away in the constellation Cygnus. Their data has also revealed a relatively clear atmosphere that is rich in hydrogen. That abundance of hydrogen actually agrees with theories of planet formation, in which gas giants form around a rocky or an icy core that quickly attracts an atmosphere by pulling hydrogen out of the gaseous disk encircling an infant star. I guess that the holy grail for exoplanet astronomers is a world the size of Earth with water, and that is still the prize that is out there somewhere in the universe. They have yet to find it. I love this next story, but I read it. The story just suggests that the science of psychology may be culturally dependent and not a universal truth for all humans. What exactly does that mean? The findings of Stanford University anthropologist Dr. Tanya Lerman on her study of worldwide schizophrenics is going to be published in hard copy in January 2015 in the British Journal of Psychiatry, but it's already available online for your perusal. Dr. Lerman found that in the United States, schizophrenia symptoms classically include hallucinations of disembodied voices that hurl insults and make violent commands. But in India and Ghana, in Africa, schizophrenia patients often report positive relationships with hallucinated voices that they recognize as those of their family members who are deceased or God. Lerman says, quote, "Americans home in on the strangest, most antagonistic voices in their minds," unquote. Indians and Africans in the study spoke little of their psychiatric diagnosis. Their social worlds emphasized relationships over individuality and the possibility of supernatural contacts with spirits. Many patients in both nations regarded most hallucinated voices as familiar people who couldn't be controlled, but who were sensible and likable. Lerman, working with two psychiatrists in India and one psychiatrist in Ghana, recruited 20 people in each country receiving hospital or outpatient treatment for schizophrenia. And all of these patients reported hearing voices. Interviews with participants included questions about their voices' identities, what those voices said, and whether the patients conversed with those voices. Among U.S. patients, 14 heard voices that told them to hurt other people or themselves, and 5 described hearing voices as akin to being in a war or a battle. None of the patients reported predominantly positive voice hearing experiences. In India, 13 patients heard voices of dead kin or spouses offering guidance, scolding or giving commands to do household tasks. These voices were regarded as good, even if sometimes demanding or frightening. Only 4 people heard voices that regularly or occasionally commanded them to hurt someone. Frankly, I find it very strange, by the way.
Do the dishes! Darn you, do the dishes! This is your dad, Uncle Bob, do the dishes!
Just strange. Anyway, in Ghana, 16 patients reported hearing God or another deity, and 10 described voices that they heard as entirely or mostly positive. Others heard bad voices, but insisted that good voices, usually God's, were more powerful. Only 2 people said that voices told them to kill or to fight. Most of the patients in each country, including the U.S., were religious, so something else about participants' backgrounds must have influenced the tendency to hear positive or negative voices. Lerman states, quote, "Cultural differences in our new study help to explain why schizophrenia tends to be more severe and long-lasting in the United States than in India. Evidence on schizophrenia's course in Ghana is still too sparse for comparison," unquote. The new findings lend support to a controversial treatment approach in the West called the Hearing Voices Movement, which for more than 20 years apparently has taught people to interact with hallucinated voices as people.
"I don't want to clean the dishes, Uncle Bob! Leave me alone!"
The voice in my head is telling me to go on to the next story. So the next 2 stories are sort of meta-science stories, insofar as they talk about scientists and not about science itself. First, Dr. James Watson. If you have not heard this, the famous scientist, Dr. James Watson, auctioned off his Nobel Prize. Now remember, Watson won the Nobel Prize for helping determine the chemical structure of DNA back in the 1950s. He's probably one of the most famous Nobel Prize winners. Well, Watson, for probably true reasons known only to himself, decided that he would sell his Nobel Prize at auction and give the proceeds to charity. Frankly, at this late point in his life, this sounds like guilt talking. More on that later. Watson was able to sell the medal off a couple of weeks ago. From what I read, he watched the auction open-mouthed from the back of the room with his wife and one of their sons as the bidding, which began at $1.5 million, rose by $100,000 increments, eventually coming down to 2 phone bidders who pushed the price above $4 million. He said before the sale, he wanted to give most of the proceeds to educational institutions that had nurtured him to, quote, support and empower scientific discovery, unquote. That was not the end of the story. A week later, it was stated publicly by Russia's richest man, Alisher Usmanov, that he bought Watson's Nobel Prize and intends to return it to him. I guess that he's a steel and telecommunications tycoon, and Usmanov said that Watson deserved the medal and that he was distressed that the scientist had felt the need to sell it. Mind you, although Watson stated that he needed the money, he also said that he was selling the medal to give back to the schools that had educated him, including my own alma mater, University of Chicago. But Watson is not destitute. He is still Chancellor Emeritus at Cold Spring Harbor Research Institute, where he participates at conferences and is also active in fundraising and development. He lives in a house provided by the organization. He earned a base pay of $375,000 in 2012 and received $568,000 in total compensation and benefits that year. This is all according to the laboratory's most recent available tax findings. So I think, billionaire or not, Usmanov is a bit silly for worrying about Watson's supposed penury. Usmanov also said, quote, James Watson is one of the greatest biologists in the history of mankind, and this award for the discovery of DNA structure must belong to him. Unquote. Okay, greatest living scientist. I would argue, and not just me, many with me, that Watson is not that great of a scientist. He simply was very good at taking advantage of a situation. And his contributions after the early 1950s discovery of DNA structure, well, many would argue were minimal and simply riding on the coattails of that big initial win. Well, let's see what that great scientist has done. Well, back in 1953, he borrowed data that he needed, along with Crick, to further his structural theories on DNA. Dr. Rosalind Franklin is not known by many, but she was the biochemist that was examining DNA structure using X-ray crystallography in the nearby King's College at Cambridge. According to Francis Crick, her data and research were key in discovering the structure. Watson eventually confirmed this opinion in his own statement at the opening of the King's College London Franklin Wilkins building in 2000. Watson took almost 50 years to give the woman credit that he had basically stolen results from to formulate his own theories. In 1997, he told a British newspaper that a woman should have the right to abort her unborn child if tests could determine if it was homosexual or not. At about the same time in the late 90s, he's quoted as arguing in favor of genetic screening and engineering on the basis that quote-unquote stupidity could one day be cured. He also claimed at about the same time that beauty could be genetically manufactured and ugly people done away with, saying, quote, people say it would be terrible if we made all girls pretty. I think it would be great, unquote. In October 2007, Watson stated publicly that black people were less intelligent than white people, and the idea that, quote, equal powers of reason were shared across racial groups was a delusion, unquote. He also said there was a natural desire that all human beings should be equal, but, quote, people who have to deal with black employees find this not to be true, unquote. You begin to see a pattern here? I really wonder whether at the age of 86, Watson has not seen a path to redemption by getting rid of that medal. I wonder whether it haunts him that he took Rosalind Franklin's data without permission. I suspect many people are wondering the same thing. What is his motivation for selling that medal? Before the auction, he made apologies to those he may have insulted with his 2007 statements. He has now admitted he was wrong and had no scientific basis for his beliefs. He also said that he has felt like a quote-unquote non-person since that time 7 years ago. It's all very sad, but I wish him the best of luck if he is actually moving toward improvement of some kind. There is a weirdly related editorial that I read in the journal Biotechniques this week, and it reminded me of Watson. The story was written by the editor-in-chief of the journal, Dr. Nathan Blow. I have written over 30 scientific papers myself, and one of the most difficult tasks is determining whom to credit with the work that was done, either as a co-author or sometimes in the acknowledgement section that's at the end where you thank colleagues for help. Identifying the first and corresponding author is usually pretty easy, especially since I do most of the work myself, but deciding who should be the second or third author can lead to debate and occasionally hard feelings. And then there are those who contribute materials or single experiments to a study. Should they be authors? Should they be only acknowledged for their contributions? I mean, these situations create particular attribution challenges. And fortunately, there are kind of loose guidelines when it comes to author attributions, although interpretations of those guidelines will vary from author to author, or PI to PI, as the case may be. Remember, PI, primary investigator. Still, when someone contributes in an intellectual or technical fashion to a particular study, that person should be recognized, either as an author or in that formal acknowledgement at the end. This all seems very obvious. Author listings and acknowledgement sections kind of exist for that very reason, obviously. So you can understand my surprise when I read in Blow's editorial that for those working in so-called core laboratories at universities and research institutes, that's just not the norm. Often these so-called core facility scientists provide technical support to researchers and are almost never acknowledged within a manuscript. One might suggest that core facility staff members are paid for their work, which should be sufficient reward. But while researchers usually do pay to use a core facility for doing things like sequencing, it's also true that governmental grants to those facilities often reduce overall user costs. I mean, given that, it only makes sense that any researcher using a core facility acknowledge the core and the federal funding received to defray the research costs. It just seems that that's kind of critical information that helps funding agencies understand the extent and impact of core facility usage. In the end, attribution should be given to everybody involved in generating ideas, generating data, interpreting results, or funding a research study, which is what I try to do. I never want to ever be accused of acting like Jim Watson did with Rosalind Franklin, that is, leaving out key players. It does nothing to further the scientific process and just hurts people. Well, upward to some more joysome news. Have you ever wondered how cockroaches can scuttle around so well in darkness? They're quite amazing for being able to bolt for an even darker shadow in a room, even when you thought it was already pitch black. Well, Dr. Matt Wexstrom of University of Oulu in Finland wondered the same thing. His work examining roach eyesight was published last month in the journal Experimental Biology. Wexstrom decided to use the insect's tendency to turn in the same direction as their surroundings when the image on their eye of the surroundings moves, to find how sensitive their eyes are and to learn more about how they process visual information at very low light intensities. Wexstrom's team placed individual cockroaches on a rollerball, which insects could only touch with their feet to indicate in which direction they were moving. I guess it's like a computer rollerball. There were no figures, so I'm a bit confused on this point, but let's just go with it. Anyway, they then displayed images of moving gratings illuminated by light at intensities ranging from a lit room, which is about 500 lux, to a dark moonless night, which is about 5/1000 of a lux, and measured the insect's reactions. They were impressed to see that the cockroach's vision was very sensitive, fantastically sensitive, in fact. I mean, it allowed the animals to see gratings moving in light in as low as 5/1000 of a lux. I mean, when each photoreceptor was only picking up about one photon every 10 seconds. And when the team analyzed the cockroach's responsiveness, they realized that the insects were pooling and processing the signals from thousands of light-sensitive cells to detect motion at those incredibly low light levels. Wexstrom says, quote, "The cockroach's visual system for motion detection has to rely on unknown neural processing in the deeper ganglia in order to cope with the inescapably deteriorating spatial resolution. We hope to apply the lessons that we have learned from these sensitive insects to design better automatic nocturnal vision systems," unquote. Next story. Have you ever wondered whether the red that you see is the same red as what someone else sees? Whether you hear a piece of music the same as your companion? Whether an F sharp is the same to you as to him or her? And how about flavors? Does a hot dog taste the same to everyone? Broccoli? Sardines? Do we all experience the same flavors and odors when we eat? I can tell you that there are some foods, for example, that my wife finds quite spicy that I find almost bland. And by the way, this is not just her sensitivity to spicy foods, because this is the point. There are some foods that she finds rather bland that I actually find spicy. The taste and smell of foods was once thought to be, well, a pretty universal thing, but that has changed with the furthering of neurobiology. Who's to say exactly, for example, how a baking apple pie smells to one person or another, and so on? Two new studies were published by Dr. Richam Newcomb of the New Zealand Institute for Plant and Food Research in Auckland in the most recent issue of the journal Current Biology. And both these papers examine the very question. His results suggest that genetic variation may play a role in an individual's sensitivity to specific odors, as well as the perception of those odors through smell and taste. Newcomb and his colleagues selected 10 odors found in fruit and dairy products, and then tested subjects to see how sensitive they were to each. Then, using a genome-wide microarray, in which he looked at a whole series of genes being turned on and off, researchers identified genetic associations for 4 of those 10 scents, so 40%. These variations were independent of one another, meaning that sensitivity to one odor wasn't related to sensitivity to any other odor. Newcomb said, quote, 4 out of the 10 odors showed a strong genetic association. This is a really high ratio. If you extrapolate a little and think of the hundreds or thousands of odors you find in foods, there might be a similarly large genetic determinant for many of those different odors, unquote. That result implies that each individual could have a completely unique sensitivity profile to odors, making their experience of eating some food different from anybody else's. Newcomb and his colleagues suggest that as a result of this genetic variation, we may each inhabit our own special, quote, flavor world, unquote. To find out if these sensitivities alter the experience of eating a certain food, Newcomb conducted the second study, which was published simultaneously. Here, he took the odor with the strongest genetic association and conducted sensory tests, having subjects drink solutions and eat foods that were flavored with the odor. The data showed that those people with a genotype making them more sensitive to the odor described foods spiked with it as fragrant or floral, while those who were less sensitive described the foods differently. But differences in sensitivity did not mean that an individual was more or less likely to say that they liked or disliked the odor. Whether they liked or disliked it, the researchers found, was more dependent on its concentration and the context of the odor. Newcomb said that the next step from here is to, quote, look at odors within foods where they are usually found in order to see how different genotypes respond to an odor in its usual setting, unquote. Pretty cool. Okay, let's close the night with our usual reproductivity kind of story. Well, sort of. What caught my eye for this last article was the title of this paper from the journal Microbiome. And the title is Shaping the Oral Microbiota Through Intimate Kissing. Interesting. Interesting how the title is both titillating and kind of nauseating at the same time. Dr. Remco Kort and his colleagues decided to see just how much intimate kissing transferred bacteria from one kisser to another. Well, Remco, I have to admit, that is not something that ever occurred to me to examine, but good on you for coming up with the idea. The paper says that their motivations had to do with a better understanding of how microbiomes are formed in the mouth. They state that variations of the microbial communities associated with the human body can be caused by many factors, including your genetic makeup, your diet, your age, your surroundings, and your sexual behavior. They investigated the effects of intimate kissing on the oral microbiota of 21 couples by self-administered questionnaires about their past kissing behavior and by the evaluation of tongue and salivary microbiota samples in a controlled kissing experiment. In addition, they quantified the number of bacteria exchanged during intimate kissing by the use of marker bacteria introduced through the intake of a probiotic yogurt drink by one of the partners prior to the second intimate kiss. And you have to wonder whether the research team insisted on videotaping it all at close range. So what did Court and Company find? Well, they found that average partners have a more similar oral microbiota composition compared to unrelated, or I guess unromantic, individuals, with by far the most pronounced similarity for bacterial communities associated being on the tongue surface. One intimate kiss did not lead to a significant additional increase of the average similarity of the oral bacteria between partners. However, clear correlations were observed between the bacteria and the saliva of couples and self-reported kiss frequencies, and the reported time passed after the last kiss. In control experiments for bacterial transfer, they identified the probiotic Lactobacillus marker bacteria in most kiss receivers, corresponding to an average total bacterial transfer of 80 million bacteria per intimate kiss lasting of about 10 seconds. So what's the upshot here? The study concludes that shared salivary bacteria require a frequent and recent bacterial exchange and is therefore most pronounced in couples with relatively high intimate kiss frequencies. The bacteria on the top surface of the tongue is more similar among partners than unrelated individuals, but its similarity does not clearly correlate to kissing behavior, suggesting an important role for specific selection mechanisms resulting from a shared lifestyle, environment, or genetic factors from the host. Finally, the results imply that some of the collected bacteria among partners are only transiently present, while others have found a true niche on the tongue surface, allowing long-term colonization. Yummy. So to conclude, you and your kissing partner are only going to have similar bacteria in your mouth if you kiss consistently and frequently. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Don't sell your Nobel Prize unless you have to. Kiss consistently and frequently to homogenize your oral microbiome. Remember that Uncle Bob wants you to clean those dishes in your sink, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.